Polytheism. The first talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 3, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I think we're going to get started here. The class here, the course here, I anticipate will go the entire year. It's the history of ideas as over against the Bible and the biblical worldview and the biblical message. I finally got off the dime and offered this class because I was offering a biblical philosophy class for middle schoolers, and I got a lot of adults who wanted to attend. So I made a promise to myself that I would offer this for adults. What I'm not going to do is lecture, exactly. I'm going to talk a lot, but what I mean by I'm not lecturing is I don't have a lot of time to review and prepare. So what I'm offering you is the material that I've digested over decades of studying philosophy. So this is my digestion, which means I may have lapse in memory at times. I may get a little bit confused. So please understand that this is not my scholarly approach to this topic. This is my sitting across the table having coffee with you talking about what I think I know. That's all I can offer you at this point. But that is what I'm offering you. We'll begin way, way, way back in ancient polytheism. That's what we'll talk about tonight and, if need be, tomorrow. And then we're just going to march through the history of Western civilization and then the history of philosophy. We'll move from ancient polytheism to the pre-Socratics. I'll be talking about the Bible all the time, so we won't set that aside for a separate topic. But we'll move from ancient polytheism to the pre-Socratics, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Anselm, Middle Ages, modern philosophy, right on through. We'll deal with some individual philosophers at times. We'll deal with schools of thought, just whatever has helped me in understanding the story of the history of ideas and the flow of thought and the formation of our culture today. So that's where we're headed. Feel free to just carry on a conversation with me. We do have a handheld mic, so you know, get my attention. We can get the mic to you, and then we'll just carry on the conversation. If you want to argue with me about something and the argument gets way too involved to carry on here, I'll ask you to meet me outside, and we'll duke it out there. Okay. So we begin with ancient polytheism. We're looking at ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia, primarily Mesopotamia and Egypt. What I am saying, I think, pertains to ancient Greece as well, Roman polytheism as well, but I'll focus on Mesopotamia and Egypt primarily. It begins with a belief that ultimate reality, I'll get there. It begins with a concept of a god, and we need to understand the concept of a god if we're going to understand ancient polytheism. A god, I would argue, for the ancient world is simply what I would call a reality-shaping or reality-determining force. So anything in our reality, anything in our experience that influences the way our lives go and what they look like and what the character of my experience is, that's a god. So rain is a god, or tornado is a god, a hurricane is a god, a famine is a god, love is a god, hate is a god, war is a god, poverty is a god. I mean, basically anything that you could describe abstractly that impinges on your life and determines what direction your life is going to go and what the character of your existence is a god. So notice that in the pantheon of the ancient world, the gods were identified with what we would consider to be abstract ideas. War, hate, love, prosperity, that kind of thing. Now, they personified the gods, and that's significant, and I'll talk about that. they personified them. Did they think they were actually persons? I don't think we have any way of knowing for sure. Undoubtedly, the peasants, the peasant class, or the unsophisticated, uneducated classes of people, in all likelihood, did believe that the gods were real persons, that it had real existence. I think that's probably likely. But what about the unsophisticated classes in the ancient world? The priests who actually took produce and put it on the altar in order for the god to eat, and then came back the next morning and it wasn't eaten. You know, it was still there. What did they think was going on? In all likelihood, I don't know about all likelihood, but it's very plausible, let me put it that way. It's very plausible that the more sophisticated classes recognized that personifying the gods, personifying these reality-shaping forces, was more or less a metaphor. It was a way of speaking. It was a manner of thinking about them. And we'll talk about why persons, why personify them, why a metaphor of a person. We'll talk about that in a second. But it may very well be that they did not actually believe that there were beings, persons, invisible persons somewhere living in the clouds. They may very well have understood that it's just a way of thinking about the gods, the reality-shaping forces. So the other distinctive of polytheism, then, is that that's what a god is, but notice there are many of them. And that in and of itself is not remarkable, because there are many things that impinge upon our lives. But what's noteworthy about polytheism, and it's a critical difference from the biblical worldview, is what happens in your life is, for the most part, the net effect of all the different gods operating on your existence, impinging on your existence, and influencing your existence. You have all these different various gods that are shaping, controlling, determining your reality, and they're all working at cross purposes. They don't necessarily have the same agenda. They're not involved in the same project in your life. One god may hate you. One god may love you. One god may wish you good and well and work toward your well-being. Another god may work toward your harm. What happens in my life? It depends on which prevails. It's the net effect of all these different forces at work in my existence and in my life. Notice the problem there. The problem there is that there's a lot of insecurity inherent in that worldview. Who's going to win? How do I know what's going to be the ultimate outcome? There's no way of predicting that, because you've got many various forces working at cross purposes with each other and independent of one another. Independent of one another up to a point. And then the next thing you need to understand about polytheism is up to a point, because even though in principle all these gods are working independently of one another and at cross purposes with each other, yet almost every ancient religion believed in what typically gets called something like a God Most High. There's the God Most High that our city-state worships and that we celebrate and we honor as a society and as a culture. In Babylon, the God Most High was Marduk. In Egypt, the God Most High, over the millennia, it changed. Early on, it was Horus, and then a little later, it became Amun or Re, or sometimes hyphenated Amun Re. And it was identified with the sun. We'll talk about that in a second as well. What was the role of the God Most High? The role of the God Most High was to take a relationship between the gods and reality that otherwise would be incredibly chaotic and bring order to it. How? Because the God Most High imposed his will on the will of all the other gods. They needed to knuckle under and do the will of that god, Zeus, was the, in effect, the god most high in the Greek pantheon. So they all had to serve the purposes of Zeus. Could they rebel? Yeah. Would they suffer the consequences? Probably. But the biggest, baddest dude on the block was the god most high, and with an iron fist, he made all the other gods fall into line, knuckle under, and do his will. So what otherwise would have been incredibly chaotic had some semblance of order. And this is going to become critical. To understand ancient polytheism, we have to understand the distinction between chaos and cosmos. Cosmos, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of the solar system and so on, but the basic fundamental meaning of cosmos in the Greek language and the Greek concept is one of order. Any ordered system is a cosmos. We get cosmetics and cosmetology from that. It's when a woman orders her face that she's bringing cosmos to her face. Cosmos is any ordered system. One of the most significant mistranslations in the New Testament, I think, is almost always the English translators translate cosmos as world. But there are places, I would argue, when in Colossians he talks about the stoicheia tou kosmou, the elementary principles of the cosmos, he doesn't mean of the world. There he's talking about the ordered system of offerings and rituals in the Mosaic Covenant. But it's a ordered system, and so the word used to describe it is cosmos. So any ordered system is cosmos. The opposite of cosmos is chaos. In the polytheistic worldview, ultimate reality, original reality, ultimate being is chaos. And all our lives, our experience, though everything is going to collapse into chaos unless something can bring order to it. And for ancient polytheism, the order was brought into being by the God Most High, Marduk, Amun-Re, Zeus, whoever. As long as he stayed in control, then the kind of order, the semblance of order that I experience now will remain and will persist. But boy, what happens if he loses his grip? If he loses his grip, we're doomed. So why do you worship the God? You worship the God to feed him, to strengthen him, to give him leisure, to ultimately to empower him, to give him power, because you don't want him to lose his grip. Now, if any time you have a question, please feel free, but how does that relate to the Bible? Growing up in Sunday school, I was taught polytheism is where you believe in many gods, monotheism is where you believe in one god, and we don't believe in any of the gods of the polytheists. Well, nonsense. Of course we believe in the gods that the polytheists believe in. We believe in war, famine, hurricanes, tornadoes. We believe that they are forces to be reckoned with. We believe they can make or break your life, destroy your experience, or give you prosperity. We believe that all the time. And we'll go to church and have seminars on biblical principles for parenting or marriage or business or whatever. Biblical principles for how to please that God, for how to serve that God. There's nothing wrong with believing in the gods. That's a reality. The question is, what's their status? What's their relationship to us? In the biblical worldview, God is not merely the God Most High. God does not bring order to our lives because he's the toughest dude on the block. God brings order to our lives because it's just inherent and intrinsic to who he is and his relationship to our experience and our reality, that it's his will that will always and ever and only get played out in reality. He cannot not bring order to our reality because the very act of bringing us into being is God creating the order that's coming out of his mind, his rational purposes, his creation. So he's a qualitatively different kind of God, if you will. He is the only reality-shaping force, because any other God in our experience is only and always doing the will of Yahweh, of the God of the Bible. You following me? And you get that right from the very beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 1:1. How does God bring the world into existence? Let there be light, and there's light. Let there be this, and there's this. Let there be that, and there's that. He doesn't break a sweat. He doesn't have to bare his forearm and show his strength. He doesn't have to bend anything or break anything or shape anything. All he has to do is will it to be, and it is. You don't find anything like that in ancient polytheism. In ancient polytheism, the God Most High is a warrior, and he has magic nets and swords and spears, and he's strong and he's mighty, and it's through his might and his power that he conquers the other gods and brings them into subjection and fashions the world. In the Akkadian creation myth, Marduk, at the behest of all the other gods together who are being bugged by their mother and father gods, has them slain. And Marduk is the champion who slays them. And then he takes their carcass and cuts it in half. And with one half he makes the heavens, and with the other half he makes the earth. But notice he's having to work with material that already exists, and he has to exert himself and use his strength and power and might and craft in order to bring it into existence. God doesn't have to do any, Yahweh, God in the Bible doesn't do any of that. He just says, I think I want light, and there's light. I think I want this, and there's this. Can't remember what else he wants, but whatever it is he wants, he gets it. Fundamentally, completely different conception of God's relationship to reality. Okay, another difference between the gods in polytheism and the God of the Bible is the concept of their transcendence. This is a critical concept for understanding the biblical God. Do the gods in ancient polytheism, do they transcend the world? Yeah, they transcend the physical world. They transcend the material world. They transcend this plane that we live on in embodied and have an embodied existence. They are invisible. They're not embodied. They're not made of stuff. They're not physical. So they transcend physicality, but they don't really transcend being. They don't transcend existence. We be on the same plane that they be. They are at the same plane that we are. It's just that they're upstairs and we're downstairs. So if you think of reality or the house of being as a two-story house, the gods live in the upper story and we live in the lower story. In principle, if one knows where the staircase is and how to climb it, a human being could sort of go up there and hang out with the gods. And similarly, the gods could descend, come down, and hang out among us. There's no real logical barrier to prevent us being with them and them being with us. I would argue that the biblical worldview, again, is fundamentally, drastically different from that. Because the God of the Bible is the builder and architect of the house, but he dwells completely apart from the house. He's not in the house of existence at all. He's completely apart from it. So this house with no windows, no doors, impenetrable walls, we can't go where God is. We never could go there. We never can be there. God is completely other than us, away from us, apart from us. That's very, very different than a polytheistic God. God, therefore, in the Bible, God is transcendent, not because he transcends physicality, but because he transcends created being itself. And the way I'm accustomed to thinking of it for myself is that if we are real, God is super real, is more than real. God is not real. He's more than real. He's beyond real. He's above reality. The way the philosophers tend to describe that in the Middle Ages is everything in the created order has what they call contingent being or contingent existence. And what they mean by contingent being is we be, but we could have not been. We be, but it's possible that we didn't be at all. Whereas, verb to be is very difficult to work. Whereas, necessary, God in the Bible has what the philosophers call necessary existence. Not only does God be, but it's not even possible that he could have not been. His being just is and had to be and must be. So that's a way of getting at the nature of his existence. He's not just one more of us. He's not just one more, what's that song? One more bum on the bus or whatever. He's not just one more bum on the bus with us. He's outside of that. And in the plane of his reality, he couldn't not be. Unlike us, we didn't have to exist. Okay. The other thing to understand about, and this will become important when we get to the pre-Socratics, the other important thing to understand about polytheism is that while the gods were transcendent, they transcended physical reality, nonetheless they always had tokens within reality. Hence in Egypt, the sun. So you often hear that the Egyptians worshipped the sun. Well, did they worship a ball of hot gas? I don't think so. Because when you hear them talk about Amun-Re has attributes and qualities that ball of hot gas does not have. Omniscience, existing everywhere, being everywhere, and that kind of thing. They're not talking about the object in the sky, the astronomical object. So why call him the sun? Why connect him with the sun? Because they had this tendency to think that there were tokens within reality that became the locus of the power and authority and influence and effectiveness of that god. The god is everywhere on the one hand, but on the other hand, his power is especially enhanced here at this mountain, or at this tree, or at this stream, or in this building, a temple, if you build a temple. Or they even built little clay objects, fashioned little clay objects, and carried them around in their back pocket, and that was the god too. Well, they don't mean the clay object is the god, obviously. But what they mean is it's one of his tokens, and it's a place where his power is particularly focused and particularly focused. So there are places that are sacred or holy. There are objects that are sacred and holy. There are buildings that are sacred and holy. And all that is throughout the ancient polytheism. Any given god can have more than one token. He's the sun on the one hand. He lives in this temple on the other hand. That tree is his tree on the other hand. That there's no limit to the number of tokens that could represent that god in our reality. And then most significant... Yeah, question?
We have a question from the online. They would like to know if you could talk a little more about the necessity of God's being. What does it mean to be necessary, I presume, is the question.
Okay. I think the answer is no. The question was to talk a little bit more about God's necessary being. That I think the concept of his necessary being. Okay, let me try it this way. In theology, the way they get at it is they describe one of the attributes of God as his aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y, God's aseity, and usually gets translated something like his self-existence. I think self-existence is a little bit misleading because, but But nonetheless, it's trying to get at this idea of everything in our lives. I mean, just the way human intelligence is structured. We are, our mind is structured so that when something happens, what's my immediate question? Why did that happen? Explain it. Give me an explanation for why that happened. Why that object is there, why that thing is there, why that event occurred. Human intelligence just craves, not the right word. Human intelligence just naturally expects that there's an answer to that question. So we keep asking that question about one thing or another thing. We get to cosmos, the creation, and we ask the question, why is that there? The biblical worldview gives an answer to that question. Why is the created order there? Because there is a transcendent creator who decided that, who willed that it be there. Okay, then the next question, and this is Bertrand Russell's question, the next question is, well, where did God come from? Now, asking the question is perfectly natural. That's a perfectly intelligent thing to ask. But what somebody who believes in a biblical worldview says in response to that is, my answer to the last question, namely that God is the cause of the created order, has taken me beyond my experience. I have an explanation for why the world is here, but except to the extent that that God who is there reveals himself to me and or enters into my experience, unless he enters into my experience and unless he reveals himself to me, there's no way I can know anything more about God. So I can't possibly answer the question, where did God come from or why does he exist? So it really is, when we face God, we're facing a limitation on human knowledge. Human knowledge couldn't possibly answer that question or have an answer to that question. And I know, I'm intelligent enough to know that I couldn't possibly have an answer to that question. So how do we mark that? You know, how do we signal the fact that I've reached the end of my ability to know something? Well, happily or unhappily, the way theologians have done that is to say, well, God is self-existent. What they really mean by that is, God has an existence that you can't expect me to explain why it is there. And I don't think we can know anything more about self-existence than that, is that we've reached the limits of my knowledge. Sometimes people talk about it in a way that it sounds like they know something that we don't know. That, well, I've looked at God and I've studied and analyzed his existence and it's self-existence. You know, as if we could know. I don't think we know anything about it, but we know that we don't know. And we know that we're not going to come up with any explanation. So strictly speaking, logically, could there be some reason and some cause for God's existence? Yeah, I suppose. But I'm never going to know. And I never could know. And that's fine. Because I'm never going to be in a position where that matters. I'm never going to be in a position where that's relevant for me to have the answer to that question. Any comments or questions here? Okay. One of the tokens, this is especially true in Egypt, you can just go online and you'll see all kinds of inscriptions that they've dug up in Egypt where the pharaoh will be given the title son of Horus, or son of Amun-Re, or son of Re, just son of Re. What do they mean by that? They had this concept that, you know, God can focus his power and authority and influence in a place, in a temple, on an altar, on a tree, on a mountain. But he can also focus it in a human being. And the Egyptians believed that Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, was one of the tokens, if you will, of the god Re. So, and the way they describe that is, he's the son of Re. And what effectively what they mean by that is, this human being is the embodiment of the influence and power and authority of the god Re. Now, what we don't have, you have all kinds of discussion in Christianity, is what does it mean to call Jesus God? I don't know any discussion in anywhere among the Egyptians about what does it mean to call the Pharaoh God. They didn't get into the intricacies of that. But however they would have understood that and however they would have worked it out, if they had even bothered to work it out, the one thing that's clear is that in some sense, the Pharaoh, though a human being, is their God Most High, manifesting himself. I think that's the backdrop to the promise that God made to David in the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7. He comes to David. David's about to build a temple to God. And through the prophet Nathan comes to him and says, God says you're not going to build the temple. Don't build the temple. You're not going to build a temple for me. I'm going to build a house for you. And then as he goes on to explain that, the house that he's talking about is the dynasty, the household of David and his descendants. I'm going to give you a throne that's going to be an eternal throne that is never going to be taken away from you. I'm committed to you, David, and your descendants, and you are going to be king over Israel. But not only are you going to be king over Israel, David had already been king over Israel, Saul had been king over Israel, but God goes one step further. He says, you're going to have a son, and I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. So what is he arguing? I think what he's arguing is, you know how they do it, how they think about it down there in Egypt? You know how they think about it down there in Babylon? Up till now, you've just been the heroic leader of your people, and we called you king, but you've been the heroic leader of your people. I'm going to establish a relationship with you where you, the human being David, will be the embodiment of Yahweh's rule. My sovereign rule over the nation, and indeed, as you go on in the prophets, God's sovereign rule over all of creation is going to literally be embodied in this human being, David, and David's son, and his grandson, and his son after him, and his son after him, and his son after him. That God is committed to the household of David, to the house of David. He is going to have the Davidic king, the descendant of David, be the embodiment of Yahweh's reign over creation. Now, what exactly does that mean? Well, for in David's case, and in Solomon's case, and in Rehoboam's case, and right on down the line, it really didn't mean anything more than what it meant in Egypt. In Egypt, was Pharaoh really the embodiment of Ray's rule? Well, not really, because Ray wasn't really an independent force, wasn't really the God Most High, and Pharaoh wasn't really the embodiment of the authority of this God who really didn't exist. But it was a concept. So conceptually, the Pharaoh was the son of Ray, but not in any actual or real sense. That's the same thing with David and with Solomon and Rehoboam. They're not really, in any real sense, the embodiment of Yahweh's rule. But the concept is in place. The promise is in place. The anticipation is in place. And that promise and that anticipation gets passed on from son to son to son. And God honors it through his prophets, and the people acknowledge it with anticipate, and eventually they come to realize that turkey there in Jerusalem, he ain't no embodiment of Yahweh's rule. There must be one coming who is going to, in actuality and in reality, be the embodiment of that rule, because this dude ain't it. And so by the time we get to the New Testament, what is it that they're looking for? Who is the coming one? Who is the son of David that they keep talking about? It's the one that they expect to come who finally will be the fulfillment of everything that God had promised way back in the time of David. The one who would truly be a son and in relationship with God would really be his father. That is to say, the one who would really and actually be the embodiment of God's own sovereign reign over the world. And so when you get to the New Testament, the claim that's being made is Jesus is that one. Jesus is the one who was anticipated in the covenant with David, in the promise made to David. And remarkably, John, especially in his gospel on a number of occasions, calls Jesus the monogenes Son of God. And it usually gets translated, mistranslated, only begotten. Forget that. Cancel that. Has nothing to do with that. Monogenes, almost every Greek scholar today recognizes that monogenes means unique, one of a kind. That Jesus is the one of a kind Son of God. Well, one of a kind in what sense? Well, Israel has known many sons of God throughout the centuries. But there's one unique one who actually is the Son of God. And that's this man, Jesus. We apostles are claiming.
How is it different than only begotten?
Well, an only begotten child is a unique child. That's true. You can be unique without being begotten. But you can't be only begotten without being unique. And, I mean, the fundamental issue is the spelling. Monogenes comes from the word genes, not from the word ganao. Ganao has two N's. Genes has nus. Genes has one N and one nu. Genes means, is where we get the word genus, kind. Monogenes. M-O-N-O-G-E-N-E-S. That's how they usually translate it. And genes, the end of that, genes, is where we get the word genus, the kind. So he's singular with respect to his kind.
And the only begotten?
Only begotten means you're born. I mean, if you have an only begotten child, you have a child and only one child has been born of your wife. That's an only begotten child. But you would also call a unique child. If you had one child, you'd also call it a unique child. That's partly what confused Jerome, who translated it, is because the only other times that it's used in the New Testament are to describe somebody who has an only child. And they use monogenes. He translated it only begotten, but it means your only child, your unique child, the only child you've got. Is there another? Okay. Another, this will become important again when we get to the pre-Socratics. Another issue in ancient polytheism, as I mentioned early on, they personify the gods. Why do they personify the gods? Why are they people that they envision them as being? They're people, I think, because the one thing about persons is that they are incredibly complex and basically unpredictable. I don't care how well you know me. If we go to Baskin Robbins together, you probably can't predict what flavor I'm going to get. And, I mean, there may be some people. That's the truth. But people are complex enough, complicated enough, multifaceted enough, that there's no way that our behavior is predictable. That is, it's certainly not law-like. That is, I don't always follow the laws of Jackness. In everything that I do. Look at the laws of nature. Gravity always acts like gravity. Water always acts like water. Fire always acts like fire. Jack doesn't always act like Jack. And the experience of the ancient world was life is not that orderly. Life is pretty unpredictable. So what's the nature of the forces that shape and determine and cause reality? Where they're kind of complex and unpredictable like persons. They're not simple and mechanical and law-like like stuff in nature. So instead of having the gods be fire and air and water and earth and so on, I'm going to have it be George and Susie and Mark and Ralph. They more resemble other people in my experience. That's going to change with the pre-Socratics. We'll talk about this, but what's the ultimate reality for a Thales? Water. What's the ultimate reality for an Eximenes? Air. Something nice and simple and law-like in his behavior. But not that comes later. For most of early human history, We were impressed not with the order of our lives, but with the unpredictable disorder of our lives. And how do you explain that? Rebellious people who refuse to obey Marduk, who refuse to do his will, that kind of thing. Okay, another important element of polytheistic philosophy is they had what archaeologists call a mirror image view of reality. For those of you who go way back, and Nancy Heidebrecht, the archaeologist, came and spoke at one of our conferences, and I'm pretty sure I got this from Nancy Heidebrecht. They discovered a ziggurat. You know what a ziggurat is? In Babylon, it's their version of a pyramid, kind of a temple to the gods, a stair-step type architectural structure that reaches toward the sky. They discovered a ziggurat in Mesopotamia, and they dug and they dug and they kept digging, and the more they dug, the more they realized there was a ziggurat underneath the ziggurat. And what they finally concluded is one of the ziggurats was above ground, the other ziggurat was below the ground. So one of them was buried, and then you got to ground level, and then you had the ziggurat on top. And the question, of course, was, that's not real practical. I mean, what's going on here? And the interpretation that I think is well accepted is that they were picturing their understanding of reality. Reality is like that. What is happening upstairs is imaged downstairs. What is occurring in the heavens is always reflected by what's happening on earth. So, if you want your life to go better, you gotta change what's happening in the heavens. So you worship the gods, you appease the gods, you please the gods, you feed the gods, you do what you must to make those gods, the gods that are on your side, to be victorious and to win and to prevail, because that's going to affect your life here, because this life here is just a mirror image of what's happening up there. So, in very simple terms, if this city-state in Mesopotamia beats up on this city-state in other city-state, the god of that city-state, what was happening in the heavens when your army beat their army? Your god was beating their god. So up in the heavens, the gods were in conflict, and the god that prevailed in the heavens is reflected in the army that prevails on earth. So all of history is simply a mirror image and reflection of the realities going on and occurring in the heavens. And it's possible to influence, to some extent, by my worship. It's possible for me to influence what's happening in the heavens in order that will then turn around and be reflected by what's happening down here on earth.
Yeah. I've got a little question regarding, first, what you said about God Most High beating up and controlling the other gods.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you're saying about, what happens in the heavens is reflected on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, putting those two together, what an example of that be, like when the Roman Empire fell, would that be because in polytheism, Jupiter lost control of a bunch of gods?
Roughly. I mean, how they would have worked out the particulars, I don't know enough to know that. But roughly that. So notice when the Roman Empire falls, the pagans blame the Christians. You know why they blame the Christians? Because the Christians have ignored the gods, have not been worshiping them, serving them, pleasing them, and have been influencing other people to neglect their due service of the gods. That's why the whole thing is falling apart. So the Christians were blamed for the fall of the Roman Empire.
And then, just depending on how open the culture was, sometimes it was just, oh, look, that new god we didn't really know about from that other city is more powerful than the god we were worshiping.
That's right. Yeah, so a city-state could in fact shift allegiances. I mean, notice that's what's happening in Jericho. Rahab decides, I've heard about your god. I've heard about how your god has blessed you as a nation and given you victory. I'm on your side. I'm not on our side. And that's a religious transformation. That's not That's not a political decision on her part. That's a religious decision on her part. She's going to worship the God of Israel. And why is she going to worship the God of Israel? Because he does a better job than the God of Jericho. This probably goes without saying, but everything that I'm talking about here is the backdrop of the whole Old Testament and arguably pieces of the New Testament. We cannot understand the Bible if we don't understand all this stuff as the backdrop to what's going on there. The prophets are answering polytheism, responding to polytheism, rebuking polytheism, contradicting polytheism, and offering an alternative to polytheism. And that's throughout the whole history of Israel. That's the battle that's going on. So it's a paradigm shift. It's a worldview, a collision of two significantly different worldviews. And we see that played out in the pages of the Bible. So what about, in closing then, what about the difference between Yahweh in the Bible, the God of the Bible, and someone like Marduk in Babylon? Marduk is in control, but notice how ultimately and logically precarious Marduk's control is. He got into power by prevailing, and he had all the support of all the other gods. They all had his back, and they were all on his side. He was their champion, but they were doing this together. They had ganged up against Tiamat and Apsu, and they were going to slay them and bring them down and put themselves in power. Why couldn't that happen again? What if all the other gods gang up on Marduk? They could bring him down just as much as Marduk brought down the other gods. So within ancient polytheism, the God of the God Most High in polytheism only has a somewhat precarious grip on his power and his authority. Yahweh, on the other hand, is not at all vulnerable. Yahweh didn't get there by prevailing against other forces. God created all the other forces, and the same forces that he creates, he could uncreate if he wanted to. I mean, any threat, all he has to do is will it out of existence, and it will be willed out of existence in whatever way he wants to, according to his purposes and his plans. So nothing really threatens him. There's nothing in competition with him. So he has a very, very different conception of his power. So the word, one of the names of Marduk, you know, he's given 50 names in a hymn to him. And one of the names for Marduk is the hoop that holds the barrel together. And it's just by force and pressure that he's keeping everything in place. God is not the hoop that holds the barrel together. God is the guy who says, let there be a barrel, and there's a barrel. Very, very different image. So the word omnipotence almighty, will be given to Marduk just as surely as it's given to Yahweh. Same language is used, but a fundamentally different concept is behind that. God is almighty in a very, very different way than the way in which Marduk is almighty. And then we'll end with this. The other thing to keep in mind is ultimately in polytheism, what is ultimate? What is the original reality? I might have already mentioned this. The ultimate and original reality is chaos. The gods impose order, but they're imposing order on something more basic and more fundamental, and that is chaos. In the biblical worldview, what is ultimate? Cosmos. A rational plan by a rational God who's going to bring a rationally ordered reality into existence. It's not, God doesn't have to impose order on a primordial and pre-existent and more ultimate chaos. God has always been. And God, who is mind, who is reason, who is logos, who is rationality, has always been. So the ultimate and primal reality is the cosmic reality. I'm using that as the opposite of chaotic. Is the cosmic reality of God's own being on the one hand, and then when it gets to created reality, the cosmic nature, ordered nature of created reality. That's what's ultimate. So that, and as we'll see, that's the shift that we make when we get into the pre-Socratics. The pre-Socratics are going in the direction in which biblical worldview already has gone, is to see cosmos as original. And that becomes, as we will explore next week, the foundation, I think, of science. Ancient polytheism could never have given rise to science. It wouldn't make any sense. Because every explanation for everything is because the God wanted to. Well, what if he didn't want to? Then it wouldn't have happened. So today he does, tomorrow he doesn't. Why would you study that? There's no pattern, there's no order, there's no structure to it, there's no predictability to it. Why would you look for patterns where there are no patterns? You intrinsically know there are no patterns already. You can't get science out of that. Jeff?
Well, if the Egyptians couldn't get science out of that, how did they come up with the engineering piece of, like, pyramids and things like that? I think they'd have to have a sense of order and numbers.
Through, because there's a difference between science and technique, and therefore technology. Technique you can is empirical. You know, you discover that slapping that mud in somebody's eyes makes the eye disease go away, or this lever can lift this rock. I mean, that kind of stuff can be known empirically, and then you can build on that, and you can go a certain distance technologically on that. But you don't have a systematic understanding of the world. That's what I mean by science, is a systematic theory about how the world is put together and how it operates.
When you're talking about the uniqueness and then there was another phrase you used for Qigong, and then you said, did that make total sense? Could you repeat that a little bit?
That was a ditty.
My child can do this and this, but this and this won't happen.
An only begotten child is a unique child, but a unique child is not necessarily an only begotten child. Or something that is unique is not only begotten, but something that is only begotten is necessarily unique. Okay, we're out of time. Sorry it's so warm. Thank you for coming. I think we'll move on to the pre-Socratics next week.